We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, Buff Nation, welcome to the Buffs Insider. I'm voice of the Buffs, Mark Johnson. Now that we've gotten to the slower time of year in the summer months, we thought we would track down a number of great Buffaloes and reminisce about their careers and their time at the University of Colorado. And kicking off the summer series, we've got a great one here. Steve Jones, the great golfer for the Buffaloes from 1977 to 1981. In fact, in 1981, he was a second-team All-America for Mark Simpson's Buffaloes, a four-time All-Big Eight selection, eight-time winner in the PGA Tour. In 1996, he won the U.S. Open Championship. In fact, in just over a week, it's going to be the 25th anniversary of that. Set numerous school records, and we were fortunate enough, I recall the day in 2012, we inducted Steve with a great class, you know, the CU Athletic Hall of Fame. Steve Jones joining us, a great golfer. Steve, welcome. Thanks for joining us here at the Buffs Insider.
Hey, it's great to be here, Mark. Thanks.
You know, here I'm thinking about the 25th anniversary to that 1996 championship, and when I thought about doing you, I guess it didn't even dawn on me at the time that we're coming up with the 25th anniversary of that. That'll come up next week. Can you believe 25 years has gone by since you won that major in golf? I mean, it time flies, doesn't it?
It really does. It feels like 50 to me.
Anything special as you kind of reminisce a little bit about that event 25 years later that comes to mind?
Well, I think kind of the whole sports thing, business, whatever you area of life you're in, I think it, for me, obviously, it was golf. It was my business. Yesterday, I was watching the Women's U.S. Open at Olympic and watched Thompson kind of fail there at the end. It was just heartbreaking. I thought Lexi was going to pull through. But, you know, sometimes you think of a par 5 on 17, she could hit an 8-iron to it on her second shot, and she ends up making bogey. But, you know, it just proves, you know, you have to finish well. If you don't finish well, things go the other way. And thankfully for me, you know, I did bogey 17 coming in, but I did par 18. It's very easy to bogey holes in the U.S. Open in any tournament, but when there's a lot of pressure on you, you just can't make it happen. The great ones, they make it happen a lot more, obviously. Somebody like me who didn't win a lot, it came maybe a little bit harder to win one, but every time I was in contention, I had a pretty good percentage rate to win. There's when I was playing well, I knew I could beat anybody, but it didn't happen very often. So, but yesterday brought it down to reality how cruel the game can be and how fun it can be for, you know, somebody else. Every shot makes somebody happy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, without question. You know, and I think about covering sports all my life, Steve, you know, they're all unique in their own right, but they've got some similarities. And you talked about kind of that mental aspect of being able to make a shot or, you know, throw a pass or make a catch or get a hit, whatever it might be in your given sport. I went back and looked at some of the highlights from that 1996 U.S. Open Championship. You talked about 17, not 18. Your approach shot was fantastic. And then you had, what, a foot and a half putt, I guess, to win it. Take us out onto the green as you're standing over that short putt. What that must be like and what's going through your mind?
Well, I tried to hit it as fast as I could because I didn't want to think about it. It was one of the biggest cuts in the history of the U.S. Open, 112 people or something made the cut. It was really crazy. They had the 10-shot rule.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, most everybody's wearing spikes back then. And so you figure, you know, you're below the hole, a foot and a half, and anything can happen because there's been over 100 guys put their big foot right below that thing, you know. So it was, I knew I just wanted to get it over with. I didn't want to think about it. And I actually, my son's name is Cy, C-Y, and I said, I got up over it and I said, Cy can make it, Cy can make it, and I just stroked it in. So I just, something to get my mind off of, I guess. But, you know, things worked out. Sometimes they don't. In 1987, I hit it out of bounds at Hilton Head, aimed it down the right side, which was the first mistake, and then hit a tree and went 20 yards right and lost by one.
Yeah.
Gave Davis Love his first tournament victory on tour and the first of five at Hilton Head. You know, I finished second there to Payne Stewart, too. I was lost in the playoff after missing about a six-footer on 18. But, you know, and then sometimes you catch a break here and there, and then you end up winning a tournament. Some guys win more than others, but it's the journey, isn't it? I mean, you're thankful that you're even able to play golf for a living. It's something I grew up doing since we moved to Yuma, Colorado in 1970, and I always felt that U.S. Open is what I wanted to win. It really, as a kid, you know, we dreamed about winning the U.S. Open and,
sure,
you know, hit those four-footers for the win, and thankfully mine was only a foot and a half.
You know, they talk about in sports all the time about teaching us to overcome adversity. And I think about – and I remember watching that tournament back in the day and CBS with Jim Nance doing the stories about the adversity that you had to overcome to get to that point. It really was an amazing story. I mean, at the time, I suppose as an athlete, you're just struggling trying to get back to where you want to be. Was there a sense after you won that championship that – did you ever think back about, you know, what I had to overcome to get there, the injuries and all the things you dealt with?
Yeah, I think at the moment you don't think about it. You just try to ride the wave of good play. And almost every time that I've won, I felt like I was going to win in the next week or two, and I usually did, or at least finish top five or something. But you don't think about it that much at the time, but you know, you can kind of reminisce after the tournament, and you're just pressing on to the next week. Basically, next week I went to Memphis and started playing well again and didn't finish that great, but, you know, made the cut. And you just push on. But as you get older, obviously, you look back and go, good grief. You look at the things that happened to me in college and in the 80s and where, you know, this flat tire going 80 miles an hour, I could have died, you
sure.
know. And some people do. And things that you did as a kid and how did I – keep all my fingers, you know, and things like that. And just amazing how the whole journey is put together and is comes to that climax of exuberance, I guess, when you actually win a tournament and are able to celebrate it with friends and family.
Steve, was there ever a time after the motorcycle accident where you thought maybe you weren't going to play again? What was it that severe for you?
At first, it wasn't. I didn't think it was that big a deal. I separated my shoulder, sprained an ankle, and then pulled my left ring finger, kind of it went backwards or sideways or something, and the ligaments evidently got messed up. And I had messed that finger up, oh man, back in when I was, I think, 12 or 13, it popped straight up in the air, hitting a guy in tackle football just out in the field. And I pushed it back down in there myself, straightened it. So it's kind of as an injured finger anyway, I think. And then when I, you know, you play basketball and different things and you jam fingers and all this silly stuff in football or whatever, and then all of a sudden you get in a motorcycle wreck and, you know, the finger's not the best. And I think that's why it took a long time to heal. And then I got to thinking after 2 years, I'm like, wow, am I ever going to play again?
Sure.
And then, you know, it just kind of started feeling a little bit better, and I took it easy, and it took a long time to start hitting balls and feel comfortable with even being able to go out and play in a tournament, probably seven months or so. And then I kind of a rocky 1995, but was playing good. And then, you know, 1996 happened, had a good week.
You had to adapt, didn't you, in terms of your grip, didn't you, after your accident?
Yeah, it was kind of a long story, but basically I ended up with my left index finger. I did the opposite. Like, if you do an overlap Varden grip with your right pinky over your left index, I went the other way, my left index over my right pinky.
Okay.
Kind of like a putting grip, some people use that as, and because I couldn't straighten that index finger. I used that for 8 years. I won 4 tournaments with it, and then I went back to my old grip around, I think, 2001.
Golf is such a you know, in team sports, everything is the pinnacle is the championship, a Super Bowl or a World Series, that kind of thing. In golf, you have the majors, and obviously winning any time of the PGA Tour is a phenomenal accomplishment. But when you win a major, does that change things for a golfer?
It can. It can change it good or bad, you know. I mean, if you get caught up in the thinking that maybe you're a lot better player and should be winning a lot more and, you know, not missing cuts and not having struggles and, you know, peaks and valleys, then, you know, you're going to be in for a long haul. But most golfers realize, hey, I had a good week. Let's try to keep it going as long as I can. Keep working on stuff. And a lot of people get caught up in, like, maybe, excuse me, like in the managerial aspect where the managers get you to go to overseas and do all these different events.
Sure.
that year. And that's one thing I didn't do. I think I only went a couple times and maybe 4 or 5 tournaments extra, but where a lot of guys might, you know, try to make a lot of money for the next year or two traveling all over, and they just, their game goes to pot. I've seen it many times, and a lot of veterans warn me about that, and just kind of stuck to my guns. Had some goals where I, you know, just wanted to win some more, and the next year I won twice. And then in 98, I won again, and then just had some injury problems since then, since 99, 2000. It just kind of hindered me just enough to, you know, knock me off my good game.
Sure. You know, you mentioned one of those victories in 1997. I know you had an amazing Phoenix Open that year and what finished up like 25 or 26 under or something. And I think in sports all the time, we hear people talking about, you know, being in the zone. When you have a day like that, well, what does that feel like on the course when you're hitting everything squarely, the shots are good, you're making putts? That must be an amazing feeling. I would think as a pro athlete, you're probably searching for all the time, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, you're looking for that consistency. And I grew up without a golf coach. I didn't, other than my dad kind of showing me a few things, and then I basically read stuff in the magazines and would try it the next day out at the golf course. And I didn't really have that teaching, you know, to hone my skills, to get that, to groove that swing the right way. I just kind of went out and swung hard and sliced it. And as I got older, I didn't slice it quite as much. And then I learned to hook it in college, of the pro out there. at Flatirons helped me out. And then you just kind of develop kind of how you want to play the game. And I was a big drawer of the ball. I like to draw it. But I was never a real consistent player. Mm. And I think probably because of part of that growing up, I didn't have the correct fundamentals when in my swing that really could have taken me a good direction, maybe better, or who knows, maybe I would have dropped off the tour because I didn't do as well for whatever reason. You know, you'll never know, but it's amazing to see these kids these days that just, you know, full out rip it. The golf ball is different, so it doesn't spin like it did and go offline like it used to.
Sure.
So they can go ahead and just rip the ball up in the air and carry it 50 yards farther than we ever did. The technology's really changed, and kids have gotten stronger. But it's still, you got to make those putts, and you have to score, and there's still pressure. So in that aspect, it's still the same.
What is the greatest attribute a golfer can have? Well, what does it take to be a great golfer? Is it what's going on between the ears?
I think that's probably one of, everybody always says that's probably the main thing. Hale Irwin always stressed to me about getting your work done, you know, concentrating on what you're doing, and don't lollygag around. You know, you got to be serious about your sport. And, he was a great concentrator. He still is. Hmm. Jack Nicklaus, one of the best concentrators. The guys that are able to focus the best, Tiger, Watson, you know, all the guys that were really incredible, obviously were the best focusers in the game. But then again, you could take a guy who, let's say he was, you know, 100th in his 100th on the money list every year for mm-hmm. 20 years or 10 years. He only played for 10 years. Well, his skill level to be 100th was incredible because of his focus and what he had to do and what he had to overcome. Just because he didn't win 50 majors or, you know, 100 tournaments or something doesn't make him any less of a player than somebody who won all those. It just, he had certain amount of skills and he developed them. But, you know, I always tell people all the time, I said, I would love to see Tiger play with my body and see how many tournaments he could win. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, why don't you play with my body and my swing and my injuries, and, you know, let's see how you can do.
Yeah.
So I joke around, but, you know, when you're injured, you know, you're not going to do very good, as we know. You know, it doesn't matter what sport. There's certain guys that were injured, and they came back in the fourth quarter injured or whatever, and was miraculous and, you know, made the winning run or whatever. But on the long haul, yeah, you've got to be pretty healthy, and you got to take care of your body, and you have a certain amount of time. You have an open window, and that window is going to close. It might be 5 years, might be 1 year. You might have one good year. I've seen it on tour. A guy has one great year, and then you never hear from him again.
Yeah,
like the one hit wonders in music, right?
Sure.
It's just like, wow, how did they get that one good song, and then they never did anything? So different people, you know, different strokes, different folks, and everybody – isn't at the same level, but you could be at the same level at your skill level. So you could be as good as you possibly can be in your focus. And if you're a 5 handicap, that's the best you can ever be as a 5 handicap. You've attained the pinnacle of your sport in golf right there.
Right.
And if it's a +5 or it's a 10 handicap, but you know what? Those guys that are 10 or 15 handicaps, you know, they've made $1 billion in business. So, you know, choose your poison. It's like, would you rather have $1 billion or would you rather play golf pretty good,
you know,
for 10 or 20 years, you know?
You know, I always love asking this question of people who compete at the highest level, and I've done it in NFL players and NBA players, and I'll ask you as a golfer. So everybody at that level obviously is very talented, as you're talking about. You all play the game at the highest level. Was there ever somebody, though, that really stood out? I mean, a game, someone's game, and you mentioned Halloran, who is one of the greats of all time. Somebody looked at his game and thought, wow, that guy is different than virtually everybody else we're playing out here. Maybe it was the, you know, the Golden Bear or Tiger. I don't know who it was. But was there someone like that that you looked at their game and thought, that's otherworldly?
Yeah, I was, it's different. You know, it was different when I started in 1982. We were still using Woods.
Sure.
On tour. And to watch different players maneuver the golf ball, and pretty much everybody maneuvered it left to right or right to left or a little higher, a little lower, and they're able to knock it down into the wind. And you're always manufacturing shots. Tom Weisskopf was a guy I kind of emulated. He was 6'4", and same as me. And it just, like, okay, here's a tall guy. He's done well, so I kind of watched him. And it was, I tried to do Nicklaus's swing, but you know, Nicklaus was left eye dominant. So when he cocks his head to the right, his left eye dominant, it's okay. But when I did it, my right eye dominant, I'd chunk it. So I couldn't follow what Nicklaus was doing on that, you know,
interesting
backswing when he cocked his head to the right and swung. So there's different things like that you look at. Obviously, Tom Watson's grit. You hardly ever saw Nicklaus or Watson or Palmer. You never saw those guys when I was growing up. They never exploded, got mad, slammed a club. And once in a while, maybe just a little bit, but not hardly anything compared to you see some guys today. And I've watched a lot of guys get their careers were ruined because of anger. They can't let go of that shot they just hit. They should be 4 under and they're only 1 under and things like that. I got a bad break. It kicked left and it should have kicked right. And, you know, you're not guaranteed anything, but you can definitely have the right attitude towards everything. And that could make a big difference. And it could help you go a lot farther in any sport, any business that you ever come in contact with.
You know, you mentioned Yuma, Colorado. You grew up a good chunk of your childhood there. You're born in New Mexico. So how did you eventually end up at the University of Colorado? Did you have a lot of options? Did you look at other places? How did you eventually become a Buffalo?
Yeah, my dad actually knew the AD at New Mexico State and down Las Cruces. And I was kind of heading there initially in July of 77 because they gave me a full ride scholarship. And we didn't really have any money to send me to college. So Mark Simpson was pushing real hard. He found an extra $1,000 to give me that, you know, $5,200 scholarship, in-state tuition. And back then, you know, it's amazing. It's only $5,200.
Right.
But it was a lot for us back then. And he got a sponsor, Ron Rope, that helped give the extra money, and Ron did that every year, and I had a scholarship every year for 4 years, and it was a great experience. I'm so glad that I went to Colorado, and, you know, it was only 3 hours from Yuma, so, you know, I'd go home probably once every month or so, sometimes more, but it really ended up working out perfect for me, because in the wintertime, you can take a little break from golf. I think that really helped my longevity and maybe even my whole pro career by not playing year-round. Like if I was never recruited by Arizona State or anybody, but I just wasn't that good as a senior in high school. I had sparks of goodness, but I wasn't one of those guys that, hey, we got to get this guy. Because I was always a ladder stepper, I call it.
Okay.
Every year I just stepped up one rung every year. That's all I tried to do, is get one rung better every year, one rung better, a little better, better every year, keep improving every year. And that's kind of my whole career has been like that. And so thankfully, yeah, if you play year-round all the time, a lot of guys do get burned out.
Sure.
We had that break every winter. We had that break. And then come February, March, April, you know, our game started to come around, and it really never really came around until about May sometime.
Okay.
But all these guys that were beating us in, you know, February, March tournaments, now we were catching up to them, and then we were had all summer long to play. So it just kept you fresh, you know, and it, there's something to that. Instead of playing all the time, 35, 40 tournaments a year, as these juniors at 6 and 8 and 10 years old, they're just playing all the time. I wouldn't let my kids play only one sport. I let my kids play every sport they could possibly play, when it was volleyball, when it was basketball, when it was track, cross country. They did all of those. And that helped them, helped my daughter get a scholarship in volleyball, because she was all around athlete instead of just only volleyball.
Sure.
Tracks. And she did other things. So that, I think that's a good advice that somebody told me a long time ago, and my dad told me that. Even that's how I grew up. I did track and football, and then we got a golf team and basketball. That just made you stronger for your sport.
Yeah.
So that's important, to get strong for your sport and use different muscles instead of just the same muscles all the time.
Boy, you were preaching to the choir in that regard here. If you wouldn't have been a golfer, what sport would you have pursued?
Oh, boy. I was All-State in basketball, but when I was at the All-State week there in Boulder, actually, and we were practicing, and we were practicing for the All-State game, and Tom Chambers was on triple. He was in the triple A, and we were double A.
Sure.
So we scrimmaged against these triple A guys. You know, Tom Chambers, I think he was around 6'8 or 9 at least.
Yep.
Even as a senior in high school. And I just said, you know, this sport is not for me. they're too big and they're too fast and they jump way better than me. So I don't know if I would have been a. I'm not sure if there was another sport. I really liked baseball. I like to pitch. I like to hit. But I never honed that skill. I kind of stopped playing baseball around 13, 14 years old. But baseball would have been a lot of fun for me to see how far I could go.
Yeah. Well, going up against Tom Chambers, that was a pretty high high bar you're setting right there. He had a heck of an NBA career, so he was a good one to be challenged with back in high school. You know, we mentioned Mark Simpson, and if I'm not mistaken, I think you were Mark Simpson's first recruit, if I'm not mistaken. And,
yep.
Boy, Steve, when I got to Colorado here and started doing the games in 2004, I got to know Mark and enjoyed my time chatting with him and the friendship I had with him. Reminisce a little bit about what Mark Simpson meant in your life as a young person as you're coming through CU.
Well, he was just the perfect coach for me and a lot of guys. He had the perfect amount of discipline and fun, and he never really pushed me that hard to practice or to play, because I was always, you know, I was up Saturday mornings and practicing on my own in college, which a lot of kids are sleeping in. But I love to practice, and I love being a part of the Colorado team. And we had a really good team the last few years. Went to the NCAAs and did well. I think we were 10th my senior year. But with Mark, he grew right along with me as I was a player and he was a coach. He was young. And he learned a lot, and we had some fun times, and there were some times we just butted heads, and that was probably the best thing that could ever happen. And I'll never forget, in February of 1988, on Sunday about 12 o'clock, I'm putting on the putting green at Pebble Beach, getting ready to start my last round. I was in the last group with Craig Stadler and Bernard Langer, and Mark showed up. And I'm like, I was just shocked. I was like, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm here to watch you win your first PGA event. And sure enough, I won. I won. You know, it's my first time. And, I mean, for him to fly out there and to watch me and to show up and, to, you know, to root me on and to walk around with me. And, I mean, what a boost, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people think, oh, that's too much pressure. I have to win now because he told me. No, it was just the opposite. He was like, you know, just like he was in college. Here, hey, here I am. I'm for you. I want to help you get through this. I hope you win, no matter what. But we'll go through this together. And sure enough, it was something I never forgot. And And you never forget Mark Simpson's laugh. If you know Mark, you never forgot his laugh. And
yep.
He was the best laugher. I mean, he loved to make him laugh. I used to scare him a lot. And he hated airplanes. And we'd get on the airplane. We used to fly into Stapleton when it was really bumpy in the old days, right next to, closer to downtown. And I'm telling you, we'd have some rocky flights coming in. And I always, would joke with him. We're going down, we're going to crash. And he just hated that. He hated heights. But there was so many stories, and that's the way it should be with college guys. And he ended up being an incredible person and great coach and loved by, pretty much everybody. And I sure do miss him.
Oh, I'm with you. Amen. Like I said, I got to know him for a few years, and he was very impactful with me. And you're right. That laugh was infectious. There's no doubt about it. So do you follow the Buffs on a regular basis? I'm sure from a goal standpoint with Roy Edwards and what he's done, but I'd imagine down there in Arizona, you're still a Buffs fan, right?
Oh, definitely. I get David Platty's emails all the time. And
sure.
I've never seen a guy put so much information in an email that I'm not going to call it useless information, but it's just so deep. He goes so deep on articles and stuff you wouldn't even think about, It's just incredible how much stuff he puts in an email about each person and each team and records. And I'm like, how in the world does he keep track of all this stuff? And he's been a blessing the whole time that he's been at CU for a lot of people. And we're still friends, and it's just great catching up with him once in a while when the Buffs come into town. Maybe I'll go to a basketball game. It's been a few years, but or a football game, but it's been fun with David. And Roy's done a great job, and he's got a lot of good players. And it's tough. Colorado's tough. You're not going to get top 5-10 players in the world coming there, but. For the guys that go there, they're dedicated kids, and I'm proof that, hey, just because you come from Colorado doesn't mean you can't make it on tour, and that's something that I like to tell people all the time. I said, you might have an advantage by not playing year-round, and
sure.
you're going to be hungry in those summer tournaments, and make that your advantage.
Lastly here, I know you're still competing. How many more years do you think you'll play competitive golf on the senior level?
Well, I tell you what, it just depends on how much more I get injured. it's been quite the rocky road as a senior player. I've been hurt, injured, not played 13 years of my career so far throughout since 1981. I turned pro. That kind of takes its toll on you. You get this and that, and three elbow surgeries in your shoulder and your knee, and open heart surgery and gallbladders and backs and hands and fingers and neck problems, and you're just not the same person anymore, and it's hard to keep your strength up. But I don't know how much longer. I was going to try to make it to 65. I'm 62 now. So if I can play a couple more years and try to be a little bit competitive, a little bit more competitive. I've had a couple injuries recently, so I'm trying to get over those and try to play 5 or 6 more tournaments this year and then hopefully be a little healthier for next year. But we'll see. That window's definitely closing. It closes on everybody. And you just try to extend it to the point where you're not embarrassing yourself. And then you move on, do something else. But it's a thrill to watch the kids and ladies on TV, the skill they have, and I enjoy watching it in person too. But it's been a wonderful time for me and my career and all the people I've got to meet and get to know. And I appreciate your time today and let me kind of reminisce, like the old guys do, sitting in the rocking chair out front. But Thank you for that time.
You bet. Steve, it has been awesome just chatting and reminiscing a little bit. One of the great Buffs of all time, and was a phenomenal golfer for CU and did a great job on the PGA Tour and now in the senior circuit. Steve, we appreciate it. Again, thank you.
You got it. Thanks, Mark. All the best.
Well, certainly wonderful catching up with the great Steve Jones. Again, the anniversary, the 25th anniversary of Steve winning the 1996 U.S. Open Championship. It was June 16th of 1996, coming up here in just over a week, and he won that by a stroke over Tom Lehman and Davis Love III at Oakland Hills Country Club just outside of Detroit, Michigan. Great to catch up with Steve, and we'll continue to do this all summer long with great Buffs on the Buffs Insider. I'm Voice of the Buffs, Mark Johnson. Thanks for joining us. Go Buffs.